British Prime Minister David Cameron was in Scotland during the week trying to bribe the Scots not to break away from the United Kingdom. Will it work? The former UK Cabinet Minister Chris Huhne was in the dock with his former wife accused of a driving scam. And former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, it's revealed, has earned more than £1 million since he left Downing Street. A mere bagatelle compared to his predecessor Tony Blair, who earns more than £12 million a year on the lecture circuit. This man was one of the most famous and iconic personalities of the 20th century. But why was this man out to get him? All these answers and more to come in an action-packed half hour, because it's the real deal. Welcome to The Real Deal on Press TV, the voice of the voiceless. I'm George Galloway, and every week I'm in central London bringing you the news and views you just won't get in the corporate media. Shooting from the hip and shooting from the lip, but you could always fire back at me, at least by email, at the address showing on the screen. He spent almost 9 years in prison or under curfew without trial, but during the week Islamic cleric Abu Qatada was released to effective house arrest. He can't go out for 22 hours of the day. He can't use the internet or a mobile phone. Callers must be vetted and cleared. So what exactly has he done? That's the question, isn't it? Britain wants to deport him to Jordan to face trial on terrorism charges. But the European Court of Human Rights has vetoed that because evidence likely to be used against him in friendly Jordan has been obtained from others through torture. The European Human Rights Commissioner asks, why can't he be tried in Britain if there's evidence he's committed crimes? Which is another good and unanswered question of the British government. Palestinian prisoner Khadr Adnan is reported to be nearing death after more than 60 days on hunger strike in an Israeli hospital. He's being held without charge under what's called administrative detention, where your lawyers don't even know what you're suspected of. And he remains shackled to a bed as he nears death. Palestinian protesters demanding his release clashed with Israeli troops on Wednesday outside Ofer prison, where Adnan has been held. Chris Huhne, the former British Energy Secretary, was in the dock during the week with his betrayed ex-wife, Vicky Price. It's alleged that when he was caught speeding nearly 10 years ago, Huhne persuaded his then-wife to take the rap so he wouldn't lose his licence. After the divorce, she appears to have alleged this to a newspaper, which set the whole thing off. The case has been adjourned and we await the outcome. As if it wasn't heated enough, the temperature notched up another couple of degrees over three botched alleged assassination bids against alleged Israeli targets in India, Thailand and the Soviet Republic of Georgia, as was. Israel has been ramping up allegations that Iran is behind these alleged attacks, which followed the real assassinations of Iranian scientists. And nobody doubts that Israel was responsible for those. Israel's Defense Minister Ehud Barak took the opportunity on a visit to Japan to further escalate the war of words, calling on the world community to step up actions against Iran with more, quotes, effective and paralyzing, unquotes, sanctions. This also came after Iran said that it had made significant progress in its nuclear energy capabilities, which Israel and the West claim will lead to Iran developing the nuclear bomb, while the country maintains that its nuclear ambitions are purely peaceful. Hezbollah leader Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah denied that his organization had anything to do with these alleged attacks. I can confirm that we in Hezbollah had nothing to do with them, he said. If we had done it, I'm not scared of saying we did it. But we didn't do it. Charlie Chaplin, he was the star of The Great Dictator, amongst dozens of other great silent films, one of the biggest movie stars of all time. But this man, FBI director J. Edgar Hoover, described him as one of Hollywood's parlor Bolsheviks and asked Britain's MI5 to spy on him. The FBI had a file of more than 2,000 pages on Chaplin, compiled in the 1950s at the time of the witch hunts under Senator McCarthy. Hoover claimed he was a communist, although the closest that Chaplin seems to have got to communism that he once said at a meeting, there may be some good in communism, we can use the good and segregate the bad. That seems to have been enough for Hoover, however. The MI5 file on Chaplin was made public during the week in Britain. and shocked many. While for the FBI, the issue was whether Charlie was a red. For MI5, it was whether he presented a security risk. He didn't, was their conclusion. He was, says the file, one of the many victims of McCarthyism. Now, my hometown is Dundee on the east coast of Scotland. My mother and some of my family still live there. Dundee is a unique place. Outsiders might call it strange. It has its own way of doing things and saying things in what those further afield might find a little difficult to understand. For instance, if someone is troubling you, you might say, "I'll tell the bobby," which translates in English as, "I will call a police officer." And when you buy bread in Dundee, you ask for a half loaf. And it's not one slice down the middle, it's the full loaf. I don't know why either. Here's just a flavour of the city. A fraud suspect called Martin Ferguson was banned from a local court because he was radioactive. We don't have nuclear centrifuges or intercontinental ballistic missiles in Dundee, yet Ferguson was having medical treatment for a thyroid complaint which involved him being injected with radiodine, and nuclear experts warned that he was a toxic hazard to the courtroom. Apparently, you couldn't go near him without risking your own health. So the trial, you could say, went into meltdown. And a pregnant Dundee woman called Anne Curran has a bizarre craving. She can't go a day without munching on the local newspaper, the Evening Telegraph, or the telly, as we call it in Dundee. She says, "I could be sitting in the bingo hall and I'll start ripping out pages and then start eating them." After she finishes with the main course, she tears up the white bits, the unprinted edges of the paper, and keeps them in her bag so she can eat them when she's shopping. Anne has to stock up on the newspaper during the week for the weekend because the paper doesn't print on Saturday or Sunday. I don't know why she can't just munch her way through the mountains of weekend newsprint like the rest of us. Now, you might think that this was a PR stunt by the paper's publishers, DC Thompson, the notoriously secretive family-owned business and bastion against trade unionism and hater of me. But then you've clearly never been to Dundee. And then there's Dundee's second most famous man, after me, actor and Hollywood X-Men star Brian Cox. He's taking the lead in a BBC comedy about a fictional pensioner from Dundee called Bob Servant. Bob's actually from Broughty Ferry, the very posh part, and he spends his days duping email scammers across the world. The film is based on a series of books, one of which is called Bob Servant, Hero of Dundee. He's pinched the title of my own planned autobiography. Now, I mention all that because the Prime Minister, David Cameron, was in Scotland during the week on his quest to prevent the country becoming independent. He said he'd give the Scottish Parliament more, but so far undefined powers, if the majority votes no in the forthcoming referendum on independence. Scottish First Minister Alex Salmond called the offer a pig in a poke, and then mixed his meaty metaphors by later asking, "Where's the beef?" And as you can see, Alex, a man who knows where the beef is. Now, joining me on the line is Kevin McKenna, one of the most wise of all sages and columnists in Scotland. He works for the Observer newspaper. Kevin, welcome to The Real Deal. Cameron's visit with his Etonian, Bullingdon plummy voice, a triumph or a setback for the union?
Well, George, thanks very much for the introduction. I've kept that for future use. Thank you. after yourself, of course, in your,
thank
your
you.
Daily Record column.
Thanks, my friend.
There are some who would say that when David Cameron comes north, or any of his fellow Bullingdon Club confreres, that an immediate 10,000 votes goes to the independence movement as soon as they open their mouth.
Yeah.
But on this occasion, Cameron seems to have struck a different tone, which was also acknowledged by Alistair Darling, in that he acknowledged that the union, or the movement for the union, has a lot of work to do. He acknowledged that the SNP, the Nationalists, and Alex Salmond and his top team are miles ahead in the race, although there's and probably another 2.5 years to go. And he struck a kind of, not if not penitent, then a more realistic and less hectoring tone than otherwise would have been the case with a high Tory coming north.
He does have a Scottish name, of course, Cameron, but there's not much Scottish about him himself.
Well, I suppose he's never had to care about Scotland, has he? It's in fact yesterday at some point he poked a bit of fun at himself and said that the Tories don't really have any right to say anything because they're a very rare and endangered species. But no, there's not much Scottishness in the lad at all.
But he's kicked off what's going to be a long debate, if Alex Salmond has his way, of course, and postpones the whole thing until the 700th anniversary of a medieval battle between two kings who both spoke French and where there were Scots fighting on each of the two sides. First of all, is he going to manage to keep it back until 2014? Or will Cameron get his way and bring the referendum question over independence further forward?
I think Salmond will get his way simply because, although belatedly the race for independence or the race for votes has begun, in terms of the unionist camp, it's begun probably a year too late because the SNP have been preparing for this for 2, 3, 4 years. And they will have set the date in their own minds as 2014, several years ago. And therefore, they will have investigated all permutations and all possible means of defence by the parties of the union. So I feel that the unionist parties may already have been outmanoeuvred and that this trick would have happened or been devised 2 or 3 years ago. Also, I can't really see an awful lot of passion or intensity. I mean, could you, George, see Labour people going round doors around 2013, 2014, asking people to vote for the union?
Well, it's a difficult thing. Every time you say the word unionist and union, for historical and ethnic reasons, which you, with your name, will definitely understand,
yes.
I recoil in horror, although I am one of those unionists in the sense that I don't want to break up the union between Scotland and England. But you're right, it's not an easy thing to be, even if there were many Labour members, by the way, which my experience tells me there are not, while the nationalist trend will definitely have the wind in their sails, especially if it comes towards the end of that very auspicious, they would say, certainly historic, 700th anniversary in 2014.
Well, they've got, not only is it the 700th anniversary of Bannockburn, but you also have the 2014 Commonwealth Games in Glasgow, and you have the Ryder Cup. And the SNP are well placed to wring every ounce of publicity and goodwill from all of those events and to rack up the emotionalism when it comes to Bannockburn, even though, as you say, it was two French-speaking monarchs 700 years ago. Mm. But I'm like you. I'm working class origins, but have always supported the union and the SNP, whom I acknowledge are a very efficient political party, simply haven't given me enough reasons to consider leaving what, for the most part, has been an effective union and conducted in Scotland's best interests so far.
What's your prediction, Kevin? You're a man that knows the runes there. I mean, if it were held tomorrow, it would almost certainly be against independence. But two and a half years on, what do you think?
Well, 2.5 years on, they've got a fighting chance. If it was held tomorrow, no. But all the opinion polls have shown slight but significant increases in support for the prospect of independence. And if it's held in 2.5 years and the SNP can maintain that momentum, then I would say that Scotland has never been closer to independence in the last 300 years.
And of course, the disintegration of the once all-powerful, almost monolithic Scottish Labour machine has kind of left the field clear for them. You know, when I was young, Kevin, the Secretary of State for Scotland, Willie Ross, when he visited you, it was like a visit from the king. I mean, these people knew power, had power, and had overwhelming support in Scotland. But that's all melted away, hasn't it?
No, we don't. We do not have any. We don't have any big political players in the Labour Party. Although I have to say that, against all expectations, Johan Lamont has probably made what could be considered quite a decent start.
Yes, I acknowledge that. Yes.
She's been good in her exchanges with Alex Salmond in Holyrood, and anybody who's ever faced Alex Salmond across any dispatch box knows how difficult and wily a customer he can be. But beyond that, no, there's nobody, nobody who really commands any authority. And even just at the end of the previous week, the Glasgow City Council, the ruling Labour group in Glasgow City Council, was shown to be in absolute and utter disarray just 3 months ahead of the important local council elections.
Well, I think the only hope, Kevin, is that Alex Salmond keeps eating those hamburgers, and he might be horse to combat, as Robert the Bruce might have put it back in 1314. I'm only joking. I don't wish him any ill, but I do wish you well. Thanks very much, Kevin, for talking us through the early stages of the battle for Scotland. Now, as I said earlier, the temperature continues to rise over Iran and its alleged nuclear ambitions, with Israel stoking the fire. A US warship sailed through the Straits of Hormuz during the week in a show of force, but that looks as if that's all it was. Despite Israeli promptings, the US isn't, I think, about to go to war with Iran. With me now on the line from Washington is Carl Conetta, co-director of the Project on Defense Alternatives. Carl, welcome to The Real Deal. The US government has surely decided that there'll have to be an alternative to war with Iran. Am I reading that correctly?
I think that's right. At present, we're not looking to format or move toward a war. What we're hoping is that pressure can be maintained while also encouraging the Israelis not to go forward with what may be their plan to attack Iran.
Don't you think that it's inconceivable Israel could attack Iran without American agreement? Because, after all, they exist on your money, they use your weapons, and they're entirely reliant on you for protection in the political and diplomatic arena at the United Nations and elsewhere.
It's hard to imagine them moving forward or taking such a radical move because of the likely consequences of any attack on Iran. That's true. Though at the same time, it's possible to continually ramp up the situation so that our ability to manage it is reduced.
So what's the prevailing view in Washington, do you think? I mean, the brouhaha, as we would say, over the alleged restaurant plot, which I must say was treated with derision around the rest of the world, which seemed to say that Iran had plotted to blow up the Saudi ambassador in a Washington restaurant, no doubt killing Washington legislators along with them in the restaurant, and thus providing a casus belli. Is that noticeably receding, that tide of propaganda?
Well, that particular incident has virtually disappeared from the front burner here. There's little attention to it at this point, which suggests to me that its principal value was in shaping public opinion, adding to the weight of anti-Iranian feelings in the United States, but not taken seriously as something that demanded an immediate response. And so what we see here is one story, one brouhaha after another, that shapes public opinion and keeps the American public concerned about Iran.
And of course, the Republican candidates are vying with each other as to who has the most warlike stance. I mean, Newt Gingrich openly called live on television in a presidential debate for Iranian scientists to be murdered. If that had happened in Britain, he'd now be under arrest because, of course, one was murdered just a matter of days later.
Yes, I think that's right, that the elections here are an important factor. I think that plays into Israeli calculations, and it is meant to increase pressure on the Obama administration to, in turn, pressure other allies to adopt more and more draconian measures against Iran to keep the pressure up. So that definitely is a factor, and I think it's a factor in Israeli calculation as well.
What about the economy now in the United States? Is that a factor in the question of war, war, and more war? I mean, don't people conclude that, given the United States' parlous economic condition, the last thing you can afford, really, is not just the expenditure of another war, but the economic chaos, given where that war would be fought? Potential closure of the straits, interruption of oil supplies, the burning, as there would undoubtedly be, by Iranian retaliation of the oil fields in the Arab side of the Persian Gulf, and the multiplication of oil price that that would bring about. That must be a factor, surely.
The American public is weary of war, and its principal concern at present is with the economy. However, at the same time, it's rather easy to whip up concern about some foreign threat, and that becomes a countervailing factor. So as far as the administration is concerned, they want to go into the elections on the basis of having closed out America's wars, or at least beginning to do that, and paying attention to the economy. But I don't think you can exclude the ability of especially the president's opponents, but even those inside the administration, to refocus concern on a foreign threat. So I think these two things counterbalance, and I wish I could say that the citizens' concerns with the economy would be the prevalent factor in determining what the administration does. But unfortunately, that public opinion, that weight of opinion, does not translate directly into government action.
And yet, the campaign of Ron Paul, for example, for the Republican nomination, a man of the right, so-called libertarian, a man with some very dodgy views in the past on race, he's actually picking up quite significant support, not winning the contests, but quite significant support on the argument that America should look after its own affairs and set its own house in order, isn't he?
That's absolutely right, and I think that an interesting factor in anti-war sentiment today in the United States compared to in the past, compared to the 1960s, is that there is a strong conservative, especially a libertarian representation, at precisely along the lines that you point out, a desire to disengage with the world, and one could say it's an isolationist current in the United States, and really, for a country that tends to have that current as part of its history, the only alternative is engagement of a military sort. Militarism is the internationalist's response to isolationism. So these are the two choices that are posed for America. Either we withdraw, or if we engage, we emphasize so-called decisive action, hardline diplomacy, and always the threat, often the reality of military action.
Well, thank you for that, Carl. The way that the world's dividing at the moment, with Russia and China on one side and defending Iran and defending Syria to an extent, means that any such confrontation would be very, very dangerous indeed. Thanks very much for that, Carl, in Washington. Well, I'm afraid that we've run out of time again. God willing, though, I'll be back at the same time, in the same place, next week. This has been The Real Deal. I've been George Galloway, and you have been a marvelous audience. May you go in peace.